Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is February 2nd, 2021. My guest is economist, political theorist, and author Michael Munger of Duke University. I want to thank Plantronics for supplying the Blackwire 5220 for today's guest. Mike was last here on the program in July of 2020 talking about education. If I've counted correctly, this is Mike's 38th appearance on Econ Talk, which is clearly a record that will probably never be broken. Mike, welcome back to Econ Talk.
It is a pleasure to be the Cy Young of Econ Talk.
I think it's more of the Cal Ripken, but I think that's your line. Our topic for today is a small, narrow one. It's economics, or maybe economists in economics, and how we as economists think about and teach our students about what makes us do what we do, how we choose, how we make decisions, the economist's view of what is rational, morality. Now, I've touched on these questions in recent episodes and mentioned I'm writing a book related to these questions. It turns out Mike has been thinking about these issues too. Great minds think alike. And he wrote an article I'm ashamed I hadn't seen that covers some of these topics. And that article will be the rough basis for our conversation. It's called What Preferences Do You Want? And it was published on the American Institute for Economic Research website on June 4th, 2019. So let's start with how economists look at preferences. How would you describe that?
Well, in the article, I caricatured how economists look at preference. So let me do it in two stages. First, the way economists usually look at preferences is that we say preferences are rational. Now, all rational means is complete and transitive. Transitive means that I can't really say, you can't trade things for me and then have me want something else. Complete means that I can make a choice between any different preferences. One of the things that's complicated about—
any two choices.
Yeah, I need two alternatives.
Yeah.
The apples and broccoli and carrots, I can make a choice between any of those. I don't say I don't know. Now, one of the things that's interesting about saying that preferences are rational is that we claim, economists claim, that that's the only thing that motivates people, or that we can say it's as if that's the only thing that motivates people. So Christopher Hitchens, who actually was on Econ Talk at least once, famously said the most selfish person he'd ever heard of was Mother Teresa. Wait, how can that be? And the answer is Mother Teresa was only motivated by her preference to help the poor. Famously, she would sometimes show up at a village. And of course, Mother Teresa was a world-class figure. They were very excited. Mother Teresa's coming. We're going to put her up in a room in our house and we're going to make a nice dinner for her. And she would get there and say, no, I am not staying in that room. I'm going to stay on the street with my people. And I'm not eating this food. I'm only going to eat what the people in the village will eat. And of course, this was a great disappointment to her hosts. But she only wanted to maximize her own goals, her own preferences. So when you say economists think people are selfish, that's true, but only if you think Mother Teresa was selfish because she was acting in accordance with her own preferences and goals. So that's the way that economists think about preferences. I caricatured this in my little article saying, and this actually is something that Doug North always would do when I was in graduate school, and he was also making fun of economists. And making fun is wrong. He was using a reductio ad absurdum. So the logical approach of a reductio ad absurdum, you take the logic of this and show if you carry it to its extreme, it gives you something ridiculous. There's no reason in principle that we could not have a theory of preference, choice, and acquisition, and there's no reason if it's an economic one, it wouldn't be rational. So I tell the story of I'm in the mall, and for younger people, malls used to be these big collections of stores that people would go to. I realize that they don't exist anymore, but once upon a time, there were these things called malls. And so there's a number of stores there, and I see one of them, the preference store. And I think, oh, that's right. My wife, Donna, told me we're completely out of preferences at home. I should pick some up if I see it in the mall. Thank goodness I saw this. So I walk in, and in the store, there are all sorts of different preference orders. And those really what preferences are is I like A better than B better than C, or I like B better than C better than A. So let's suppose that two of the things that I care about are bologna and caviar. Now, which one of those should I like better? Notice I'm not asking which one do I like better. I'm saying which one rationally should I like better. Clearly, I should like bologna better than I should like caviar. It's much cheaper. Now, it could be that there are both income and price effects in acquiring preferences. If I have enough money, I can afford more expensive preferences. If the price of something goes up, I might want to cultivate a preference for something else. And of course, in the back of the room there, you have to show an ID to even think about those sorts of preferences. Outside, there's a guy in the alley saying, psst, you want some of these? There's a whole different set of preferences that are completely morally or legally proscribed. The point is that that example is incoherent in the way economists usually think of it, because we tend not to think that people have preferences over preferences. Preferences, as you talked about in the podcast recently with McCulloch, we just think of preferences being subjectively what they are, and that's it. And the biggest restriction we're going to place on them is that they're relatively fixed. And that, as Becker and Stigler explained, it's not because we actually think preferences are fixed, but because invoking preference change is the first stage in an explanation. You could explain anything by, well, preferences change. So mostly we're going to say preferences are fixed. We're going to use economic parameters like price and income change to explain changes in purchases. And that's what economics is in a nutshell. That's the maximization paradigm that economics is that we use preferences that way. My question is, for much of human history, and certainly from Aristotle onward, the idea that some preferences are better than others has been a big part of every aspect of social life except economics.
Well, you paused there suggesting I might say something. It's very kind of you. I think, let the record show, I think this is the longest period that Mike Munger's ever spoken on Econ Talk without being interrupted by the host. It's not a record it's not something I'm proud of, but I think that's true. I challenge listeners to verify that if they feel like it. And we also, of course, talked about this with Don Boudreau in a recent episode about James Buchanan, who said man wants liberty to become the man he wants to become. Man wants freedom to become the man he wants to become. Might have got that quote not exactly right verbatim, but that's the gist of it. And I think I'm going to give you Ariel Rubinstein's definition of rationality, past Econ Talk guest. He says, what is feasible? What is desirable? You ask yourself those two things. What is desirable? What is feasible? And then you choose the most desirable of the feasible alternatives. That is, you maximize your well-being, where desirable is not judged. It is subjective. It is up to you. It is not under the purvey or purview of economists. We just take that as given. And we assume that people, whenever they do something, it must have been the thing that gave them the most well-being, vaguely defined and unspecified. And the idea that you might want to have preferences about your preferences, that you might decide to try to change what is desirable, is something I was never taught, never thought of. It's actually vaguely heretical, as you suggest, in our guild, our religion of economics. I mean, as you say, once you do that, we're back to square one. I mean, there's nothing more to say. So I do want to say, and this will be the last time I probably say it, but there's a lot to be said for the argument that we should take preferences as given, as social scientists looking at behavior of strangers out in the world. When we look at ourselves or our children, the idea that we should take preferences as given is absurd. Now, having said that, our preferences are not fully under our choice. So the idea that there is a preference store is a fun thought experiment. I suspect I know that my attempts to change my preferences over the last 66 years have been a pretty mixed bag. There are a few things I've gotten a little bit better at, and a lot of things that haven't changed at all because they're just kind of the way I am. And certainly that's the way I say it to myself. When I fail, I just say, well, it's the way I am. Kingsley Amis said it amusingly in a book called One Fat Englishman, a book that is totally unacceptable in today's world. He said, inside every fat person is a fatter person waiting to get out. You know, the standard line is a thin person. But, of course, we can go in either direction. We can – our preferences – when we do change our preferences, they don't always move in the Aristotelian area of virtue. You want to respond to any of that?
One of the things that provoked me, and I should know, I've told you this, Russ, several times, but in my neighborhood, I'm sort of notorious because I walk my dogs often in the late afternoon, and often it's on Monday when Econ Talk comes out, and often when Econ Talk comes out, I feel moved to shout at errors that I perceive in either the guest or much more rarely, but sometimes even in the host. And at least once a woman has come out of their house to bring the children inside in sort of fear because there's this crazy person walking his dog and shouting. And it's happened more recently as you have moved more towards philosophy, because philosophy is something that I started to work on in my own way maybe 10 or 12 years ago, and learned that there were a lot of kind of preconditions that Adam Smith would have taken for granted. And to be fair, you and Dan Klein in discussing Adam Smith and others were a big part in moving me in this direction. So I should also give you credit. But the idea that James Buchanan said that we have the freedom to become the man that we want to become, that is the Aristotelian Aquinas Montesquieu project. And so Montesquieu in The Spirit of the Laws really spelled this out very clearly. And he said something that I think is a challenge to what you just said. There is a lot of things within economics. If we want to know how many potatoes people buy or how much lettuce they buy, absolutely. That's a good way of approaching it. But what Montesquieu said was that the justification for liberty is so that human beings can do that which they ought to will. That is, what I want and what I ought to want may be different things. So I don't have liberty to do what I want. I have liberty to do what I ought to want. And the question of what I ought to want is something that takes contemplation. And so there's a difference in modeling strategy that I tell students about, and they find it's very challenging to think about. So one way that we could approach this problem is to think of morality as a constraint. And I thought you and McCulloch did a very nice job of discussing this and the experiments that he's come up with about what do people do when there's absolutely no chance of being caught. Well, sometimes people still do what we might think is the right thing, even if it costs them something, even if they know there's no chance that they're going to be caught. But for the most part, one approach, and we might call this the Madisonian approach, is to think of morals as being a constraint, and that they're enforced by a law. So morality becomes embedded in a law, and if we violate morality, we'll be punished. And so the reason we obey morality is that otherwise we're going to be threatened with punishment.
When you say law, do you mean legislation or law? Or both?
May I insert a parenthesis?
Yes.
So I often give this example when I talk about the difference between James Buchanan and Friedrich Hayek. I say, suppose we started in a university, we call it Hayek University. And the first job that we have as the board of Hayek University is to decide where are we going to put the sidewalks. So now it's the first meeting, where are we going to put it? It's a trick question. We all know that we can't. We're going to wait 2 years and then pave the muddy paths. And so that is Hayek's definition of law. These things emerge from people have many different plans and purposes. We don't know why they're walking this path and not something else, but we do know that a path is the result of many different people having different plans and purposes, all engaging in basically the same act of creating the muddy path. If you pave the muddy path, then you have what the law should be. All right, now where are we going to put the buildings? Same thing won't work with where we're going to put the building. So Buchanan's question is more constitutional. We need some kind of central plan. Or what we could do is say, look, over there, I think it is. It's a group of sociologists. They appear to be massing in some sort of meeting or class. Well, that's not where you decide to put the sociology building. You have some kind of central plan or a set of rules. So you have a constitution. you have an overall culture or set of received morality that comes down to us from the past in a sort of Humean, Burkean sense. Those things are the muddy paths, and we have law to do that. But sometimes we also have to have constitutions, and we come up with a way of deciding where are we going to put the main features of this. So, end parentheses, I mean law, not legislation. So where I'm trying to go with the, and now I've lost track of where,
I completely derailed you, but before you do, I'm going to just expand on that law legislation thing for a minute while you regain your train of thought, which is, for longtime listeners, we used to talk about this fairly frequently, that legislation is what legislatures do, like 55 mile an hour speed limit. But law is what is the expectations that people have about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, which would mean that actually the speed limit's really 62 or 59 or whatever you in your jurisdiction. There, the letter of the law is only legislated. The actual law emerges from the behavior of the police, the behavior of drivers, and so on. I don't really understand that distinction in your example. So for listeners who are as confused as I am, if you've regained your train of thought, I'd like you to explain in the Hayekian Buchanan. It's like there's three things. There's constitution, legislation, and law. Uh-huh. In the Hayekian world, law are the norms, the expectations that arise, the patterns that arise that allow us to make our plans and act accordingly. And the path, the muddy path is the law. The paved path would be the legislation. Is that okay? Am I okay there?
That's absolutely okay. Okay.
Carry on.
And the location of the buildings is the constitution.
Okay, and most listeners are going, boy, these guys, what are they talking about? I have no idea.
Well, it's like we have our own little code.
Yeah, our private language. Sorry about that. Yeah. But there's 37 other episodes to go back to. You figure it out.
That are just like this.
Yeah, they don't help at all, actually. They're all the same.
All they do is confirm that those are the same thing. So I was talking about Montesquieu and the question of what we ought to will. And that comes to us in a process where we have developed a set of cultural norms and beliefs about the way that we ought to act. And so when you asked about whether those are laws, sometimes, and this is a thing that Hayek was worried about in his essay, Why I'm Not a Conservative, he had this view that we're really bad at legislation that is not a law. On the other hand, there are some laws that have come down to us from the past, like slavery, sexism, that are terrible. Uh-huh. And somehow we have to have a way to tell the difference. And a number of people have looked at that and tried to solve that problem. Buchanan's answer was that we could change almost anything through consent, but it would take unanimous consent. The thing that I think
that's at the constitutional level, not about my own personal oughts or preferences about my preference.
But remember, Montesquieu said that liberty enables us to do what we ought to will. And he thinks that there is some objective, shared, collective truth about what we ought to will that he would call culture. And so there is... this is a common theme on this show, habits. And so one of the, Alfred North Whitehead has the famous quote that Hayek also cited, that civilization actually was essentially the replacement of settings where we had to give things thought. Now, is this right or wrong? With having a habit of doing the right thing. Well, that's exactly Aristotle's notion of character. And so let me summarize for a minute Aristotle's notion of character, because I think it gets us a long way in the direction of explaining why preferences might be relatively fixed. So if I start out and I have to think about everything anew, I might apply certain principles to decide how to act. But over time, I come to situations that are relatively the same. And I developed the habit of saying, oh, I recognize this. This is analogical. And since I know what to do in this situation, I don't have to think about it anymore. Now, our character is the collection of virtues and vices that have become habits. So if you always eat too much at a party, you always drink too much if you go to a bar, if you if you have something to eat and it makes you want a cigarette. I have friends who have not smoked for years that still are subject or are oppressed by they want a cigarette after they have a drink. And so these habits are really hard to break. So we might cultivate habits of acting in a way that is virtuous, but in any case, we're going to cultivate habits of acting in ways that are vicious. So you cannot avoid developing a character. Aristotle's point is the sometimes this is mischaracterized, that the unexamined life is not worth living. The reason that's true is that your character is going to be vicious, that is characterized by vice, rather than virtuous, characterized by virtue. So it is your job to make of your life a project to develop good habits. Now, Adam Smith was really optimistic about this because he thought there was an outside force acting to aid us, and it was propriety. And propriety is the received wisdom that the culture has accumulated over time. So things are getting better for Smith. And the reason is that propriety helps us to develop a character that is more virtuous than vicious. Now, people who live outside of good society, yes, propriety is not much of a constraint for them. But it is precisely those people who care about propriety who are most likely to rise in society, and it's partly for that reason. So society itself provides us with a mechanism for making this something more than just a constraint. So I said there were two modeling strategies, and one is to treat morality as a constraint, and I think most economists are tempted to do that. We will do anything we want to do except that morality and the law, by which I mean the law, not legislation, act as a constraint. Now, in addition, legislation might act as a constraint. We might be forced to do things that are wrong. So in a repressive society, I might be forced to do things that are wrong against my will, even though I know that they're wrong. Now, that would mean that maybe I would cultivate a character of viciousness. So some societies can be bad that way. On the other hand, Rousseau and a number of people who followed him, and I would put Montesquieu is actually before Rousseau, but this is a more Aristotelian notion. Instead of making it part of the constraint, you could make morality part of the objective function. Yep. So the reason that I act well is not that I will be punished otherwise, but because it feels good to act well. And if you cultivate the habit of giving yourself plaudits and rewards for acting well, you can actually greatly increase your ability to do that. And you actually gave a very interesting example about visiting the sick. That I don't want to go to a hospital and visit someone who may be dying. It's really sad and depressing, and I might catch something. Hospitals are scary places. I don't want to do that. Except that if you do it and you start to realize that it makes a difference, maybe more than most of the other things that we do as professionals, it becomes part of the objective function. Rousseau had a really great way of saying this. He said the correct way to solve the problem was to inscribe the law on men's hearts.
Yeah. Nice line.
So if you inscribe the law on your heart, it's not that I say, okay, I'm going to do this. I better check. No, it's illegal. I can't. I'm sorry. You know what to do because it's been inscribed on your heart. Now, under those circumstances, though, it really needs to be the right thing. We need to have inscribed the right things on people's hearts. And so this has led us to a situation Patrick Deneen and others have said about liberalism. Liberalism says you can do whatever you want. Well, I'm not sure that's exactly what liberalism says, but there certainly is a version of liberalism that's not too much of a caricature that has that view compared to Montesquieu's much more conservative vision that liberty is just there so that we can do what we ought to will. And there's two kinds of injustice. One is we're forced to do what we ought not to will, but the other is we will things we ought not. And so it's the second is the problem of the individual. The first is the problem of the state, and bringing those things in harmony, the Constitution, the legislation, and the law, is a really hard collective problem.
And for listeners who's that was also maybe your longest or second longest oration. You're on such a roll today. I'm leaving you alone, but I want to help listeners who might be a little bit lost with a practical example. Before we do that, which will be the wallet. Before we do that, I do want to just make a couple comments. There's a great line from Burke that I think I got from Scott Neustock's book, even though we didn't talk about in the episode, which was that our passions forge our fetters, meaning we think we're free, but if we're not careful, we'll be enchained. Those fetters or chains will be enchained and restrained by our and be slaves to our passions, our innate wants, not the things that we ought to want. I think that's very powerful. The hospital story you referred to, I think, was from the McCulloch episode that was released this morning. If listeners want to listen to more about that. But I want to talk about the wallet, because I think the wallet gives us a way of thinking about this issue of the constraints and putting in the objective function for people who aren't academic economists who might be a little bit confused. So it's weird, because I thought of this example, at least I think I did, in a conversation with high school students. I think I mentioned it recently, and you used the exact same example in your 2019 article. Slightly embarrassing. Did I read it and not remember that I'd read it? Or did I steal it and I'm pretending I hadn't read it? I think it's neither. I think I hadn't read it and it just we thought of it independently. It's kind of a classic example. But I'm slightly embarrassed, Mike. I'm about to say that. But anyway,
where I published it was extremely obscure in terms of academic publications. And so I got the example from Doug North.
Okay. It's an honest man. Doug thought of it himself. No, I'm sure Doug got it from Aristotle or somewhere. Anyway, so here's the problem. The problem is I'm walking down the street. I find a wallet and no one's around. And, I hate these hypotheticals usually because there's really no such thing as no one's around. There's really no such thing as no one will ever know. There's always some lingering uncertainty about that that makes it difficult, even in an experiment. You'd have to really know a lot about, say, technology, the experiment, to really feel confident that it was anonymous. But let's pretend, because I think it's useful in this case, that no one is around, no one sees you, and you find the wallet, you open it up, it's filled with 20s and 10s and 100s, has a lot of cash. And there's an ID card in the front with a phone number and address that's nearby. It's really not a big cost to return it. The big cost is not getting to keep the money. So what do you do? And I'd ask these high school students that, what do you find? What's rational? What does economics predict? They were all convinced that economics predicts that one of two things. Either you should keep the wallet because that way you'll be able to buy stuff with it and get a higher level of utility. Or maybe you shouldn't, in case if you ever lose a wallet, somebody will return it for you, which, of course, not something you want to rely on and is not related, in fact, at all to this case, except as a moral Kantian consideration, which we'll put to the side, is already too complicated. But my question is this. What I said to the students was, well, what if you feel guilty keeping the wallet? Doesn't that mean that it would be rational to return the wallet? And that's your example of putting morality into the objective function, into the preferences. I want you to talk in a second about the constraints, but the question I want to raise, which I think brings us back to this whole question of Montesquieu and the question of virtue ethics, the question that Aristotle raised of character and what should be your natural response. So for me, just for example, I like to think, and maybe I'm fooling myself, that's actually not a decision I make about whether to keep the money and throw the wallet in the bushes and move on. I just something I don't think about it. I just want to return the wallet, and just a question of how hard it's going to be to return it. And you could argue I've gone somewhere down the Aristotelian path. The question I want to raise is this. What preferences do I want to have? That is, which is our first question, which is, in this case, would I be I don't know what word to put in front of person, happier, better off person, if I didn't have a conscience? Do I want to raise my children to not feel guilty? I want to tell because I didn't do it that way. I raised my kids to feel guilty when they lied and when they stole. And when my son tried to get my other son to make a really bad baseball card swap, that it was to the disadvantage of the younger one because he didn't know anything about who Adam Wainwright was or was going to be. And I knew that was wrong. It was just wrong. And I told him as commissioner, I veto that trade. I haven't talked about that for ages on here, but a long time ago I did. And so do I tell my kids, consciences are for suckers. You don't want to have a conscience, because if you do, you're not going to enjoy that wallet. You want to live in a world where you can just take the wallet and keep it. But most people would feel uneasy about that, I think. The man I want to become is the man who returns the wallet, the man who is welcomed in civilized society, because that person is honorable and can be trusted to do the moral thing when people aren't looking. Now, that just complicates everything for what we've been talking about. For me, that kind of helps us maybe have a framework for talking about it. So explain to me how that fits into your example, because it's your example too, Doug Norris. And whether as I raise my kids or myself, because that's the whole project, as I'm growing up and becoming the person I want to become through my habits, do I want to be a person who returns wallets or keeps them? Does economics have anything to say about that?
The interesting part about Doug's example, and again, I mean, you can say this is reductio ad absurdum, but it is almost a Beckerian, that is after Gary Becker, application of economic reasoning to a setting where it's not normally done. What North said was that this is probably subject to both price and income considerations. And you actually laid it out in your example. It's nearby. It doesn't cost me much to return it. Suppose that's not true. Suppose it actually is really expensive or difficult for me to find the person. Well, at the margin, that'll make it less likely because demand curves slope down. Now, I don't know what the level is, but at the margin, it'll make it less likely. Now, suppose that I really probably cannot get caught and there's $10 in it. Then I'm probably going to return it. Suppose there's $1,000. Suppose there's $10 million in it. The question is, and this was North's question, suppose you could do experiments and you actually could enforce the conditions pretty well. Is there a price where anyone, literally anyone, would not return the wallet? It's just that they differ about what price that is. Is there a different level at which all of us would say, you know, this is so much money, I'm keeping it?
So that whole idea, this is a G-rated program, so I'll give the G-rated version, you know. Mike, would you?
Winston Churchill.
I heard it from George Bernard Shaw. Would you? Mike's not interested in having dinner with me tonight, but I say, okay, Mike, how about for $100? If I paid you $100, would you have dinner with me tonight? And you say, no. How about $1,000? No, I don't like having dinner with you. And then I say, how about $1,000,000? And like, well, what kind of person do you think I am? And the answer is, we've already established that we're just talking price. And in The Economist, But in The Economist view, the Beckerian Gary Becker view, the way I was trained, the way I taught my students for decades in the classroom is that, yeah, demand slopes downward. I used to say this with such smug glee and pride in my insight as an economist, that there's some amount of money that everyone would do something immoral for. It might be to save the life of a child, like Jean Valjean stealing a loaf of bread. You know, we all have our price. And that view of humanity, we were taught as economists, is, quote, realistic, because that is the way people pretty much behave. And yet when you tell that to people who aren't economists, they find it deeply offensive. And the reason they find it offensive, it's taken me a long time to appreciate it, but the reason they find it offensive is that it treats them as if they are merely a robot, a machine, a utility machine. And I just have to pick the right setting to get you to do what I want. And we know in human history, it's literally not true. We know there are people who stand up to the incentives and say, I know I have an incentive to do X, but X is wrong. And in economics, we have a term for this, lexicographic preferences. It means I have certain things I take care of regardless of price. And so we found a way to squeeze that into the model, but it's not really in the model. The way the model works is that people respond to incentives, and they do. And so therefore, everybody has their price to do anything. And the way the world works is that there are different prices at which different people do different things and so on. The idea that I would want to change my price, that I would want to change at what price I would do what is dishonorable, is outside the model. It's not in the model. It is not the way economists think about it. And I think it's a terrible shortcoming. And in fact, you know, if I said to you, after going to graduate school in economics, what have you learned about the life well lived? I don't know what your answer would be, but I've come to believe that the life well lived is learning how not to do what you are incentivized to do, either by money. And I'm not going to give the examples, but I have turned down money because of things I thought were reprehensible that it would take to acquire it. And to do much more smaller, more important decisions about enduring sacrifices because I thought that was the right thing to do. And so I want you to respond to that. And then I want you to tell me whether I'm a sucker. You know, what the heck? Why didn't I enjoy my older age by becoming a less moral person? where I could get to a higher point on the hill of happiness. Why would I burden myself with these constraints of morality, which I think is what exactly that's the constraint model you were talking about. Why should I do that? Isn't that it's irrational.
Let me take a little detour and come back because I think it connects.
Okay.
So E.O. Wilson, the famous entomologist, says that we should understand we should understand biology, at least evolutionary biology, as a contest between two forces. First, any selfish individual will always dominate any altruistic individual. So you could call it altruism, you could call it morality. It's a big drawback for the individual. And in fact, if we only were individuals, then the selfish individuals might very well outcompete the altruistic individuals and they wouldn't exist. Second, groups of altruistic individuals will always dominate groups of selfish individuals because we care about each other. And it's not just that we are militarily better. We're better in society. We're happier. We reproduce more. We're more economically active. We're able to trust each other. Contracting costs are less. And so any society has this tension between individual and group domination. Now, E.O. Wilson, because he's a bug man, he can talk about group selection. Friedrich Hayek was often criticized for talking about group selection because evolutionary biology is supposed to work at the level of the meme. Well, one of the questions that you asked again about McCulloch, and this was at the point when I was shouting at the dogs, but when you raised the question for McCulloch,
how do you bring in those kids? That man's out there yelling at himself again.
But you said, how would genes do this? How would genes actually operate at the way? How would genes know? Well, genes wouldn't have to know. What genes would do is evolve in a setting where we live in small clan groups, no larger than 150 or so, because of the Dunbar number. That's the level where we can organize things just by keeping track of reputations. And if you act badly in that setting, you'll get put outside the wall and eaten by wolves. So we pretty quickly select. And we have big brains. We're good at detecting dissembling. And we remember when you said you would do something you didn't. So there's a lot of selection at that level. Getting put outside the wall is really bad. It's not a joke. This is not a night in prison. This is your legs
Death.
Get bitten off.
Death.
So, but at some point, when we get into larger groups, then it may be more difficult for us to detect dissembling. We may have to have other rules for deciding whether we're going to detect dissembling. And things that were evolved at the other level may not work as well. So there's the Westermarck effect. So the Westermarck effect was named after Edvard Westermarck, who claimed that the source of the taboo against incest was the fact that young people raised together assumed genetically that they were related. So unrelated people who were raised together never had any attraction for each other. And so there were a number of experiments in kibbutzes in Israel in the 1960s and 1970s that showed that people that had been raised together were much, much less likely, even though they were unrelated. So your genes don't know you're unrelated. Your gene says if you're raised with someone,
familiarity,
that means that your genes think you're related, and so there's no attraction. You actually couldn't violate the taboo even if you wanted, because it's written on your heart. It's not, oh man, my sister's really hot, but there's a law against it, so never mind. It's literally written on your heart, but it's because of genetics. Now, culture is the inheritance you get from the people who raise you. Genetics are the inheritance you get from the people who gave birth to you. But culture is the inheritance you get from the people who raised you. So if you're raised with a group of people, you could have people separated at birth. They're raised in different religions. There's the story of Shibboleth from the book of Judges in the Old Testament, what I call the Old Testament.
We call it the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Go ahead. That's okay. I'm not. That's fine. Shame on you, Mike. But it's
yeah.
I'm horrified, but no big deal.
The people who were, if you had twins that were raised in separate cultures, one would be able to pronounce Shibboleth and the other would not be able to pronounce Shibboleth. But that's cultural. There's nothing genetic that would prevent me from being able to say it. So the way that genes do this And this, I realize this is a complicated story, but this is the way I have come to think of it. Human beings are evolved to have what may be an atavistic, or that is a sort of throwback tendency, to accept and think, to accept morality and to think morality is really important. But the content of what that morality is socially constructed. So if I am raised in a different culture, I, the same genetic person, I would have different views about what is right and wrong. But I have an ability to think that those things are important. So I think this is a story I've told on the show before, but let me do it quickly. Once I was in Washington, D.C., and I was waiting in line for a movie. This was back when you couldn't buy stuff online. It was in the 80s. So you had to wait in line for 30 or 40 minutes before the movie started.
And you waited online because the price was too low and there weren't enough seats. So only the people who were lined up put it up and could get in. It's not just to get the good seats.
I think the price was too low because I'm rich. The poor people thought the price was just right.
Okay.
Because they had more of the resource that this was testing for. So that,
yeah, good point.
Spoken like a typical wealthy person, that everything should be the one resource you have a lot
of. No, it's the neoclassical economist who sometimes forgets that positive and normative are not the same thing. I apologize. Carry on.
In line. I'm standing in line. And if you're standing in line for a long time, you know the people around you. And I'm talking to the guy behind me, and I turn around, and there is a small, 5'2", slender woman who was not there before. And I say, "You can't cut in line like that." And she immediately looked up at me and said, "If you say another word, I'm going to call the police and say you assaulted me." Now, I was completely undone. I remember it so vividly, and I also remember, I don't remember anything about the movie. I was so upset. I could not sleep that night. I was so upset at this transgression of the rules. Now, what did she cost me? What would the economist say she cost me? 20 seconds?
Kind of. I mean, you didn't even have to pay attention to her, but you did. Your brain took it in. Is that, I mean, you're saying, what did she cost you to hear her complaint or for cutting in line?
Objectively, what did cutting in line did?
Is she in front of you or behind you?
In front.
Oh, I like behind because it's even better. Because then
I don't think it would have made a difference. I think I would have been just as upset.
Yeah, of course. But cutting in front of you made no difference as long as she didn't prevent you from seeing the movie, and she did.
Probably 20 seconds extra where she paid for her ticket and went inside.
Yeah.
I was so upset that I didn't sleep that night, and I still remember the incident. So the point is, we are evolved to provide the public good of norm enforcement against our will. It's irrational. I should not, if you're an economist, I should not have provided this public good of norm enforcement. However, if I live in a society where all of us do provide the public good of norm enforcement, there is an emotion called shame, which is, I know that I did it. And there's an emotion, forgive me, called guilt, meaning that I know that I did it. And there's one called shame where I'm upset when other people point to me and said, he did it. Those two things mean that much of the problem of policing bad action is taken away. The society actually solves the problem itself. So there is a group rationality argument, and this is something that Hayek talks about quite a bit. There's a group rationality argument for having an adapted moral sense. So morality is not a disadvantage, except that an individual sociopath like that woman might be able to invade this society as a mutant, because there's not 150 of us anymore. There's 1 million people that live in Washington, D.C. I'll never see her again. She paid no cost. So long as she has no sense of guilt, she paid no cost for cutting in line. If there are more people like that, well, the point is that they're more able to survive in societies that don't have small clannish groups. And so will this adaptive feature of human brain architecture disappear? Are we throwbacks that have this old feature that in the future societies are going to have to, you're not going to be able to say, and this actually is what Patrick Deneen is worried about, what a number of people that are worried about liberalism are worried about, is that we need small groups where we get up in each other's face when we act badly, not, oh, it's okay, you can do whatever you want.
But didn't, so that was really amazing. And I'm not, I'm not sure what to take away from that. Let me try to summarize the amazing part. And then I want to apply it to something really personal and embarrassing that it's worse than your story of sleeping badly that night, I think. So here's what I understand what you just said. You said that our desire for meaning, excuse me, I was going to use meaning, our desire for morality, for justice, doing the right thing, is not a rational choice. It is actually somewhat hardwired in us from the past. And so it is something of a constraint, but it's a funny kind of constraint because what its content is unspecified at any particular point in human history and in society.
Well, it's a constraint like hunger is a constraint, but satisfying hunger actually feels good, and so it's part of my objective function.
Right.
If I don't eat, I'll die.
Right.
If I don't act morally, I'll feel bad about myself. But I think those are part of the objective function. It's something we like.
But you didn't answer my question, sorry, which is there are psychopaths like that horrible person who cut in front of you, wicked woman, shameless. Worse.
Literally.
Worse than shameless because she was eager to accuse you of something.
Yeah.
That you had
a plan. She was looking for a big, stupid guy because it wouldn't have worked. Another woman might have fought her.
So you were a victim. Not only were you a victim of her for cutting in line, but you're a victim of her plan. Are you saying that most of us have a different set of genetic makeup so that doesn't work for us? We can't just cut in line gleefully because we'll feel bad about it. And yet there are people who keep the wallet and a lot of people actually. And I think some economists would believe that is the modal action, is people keep the found wallet. I'm agnostic on it, and I'm tempted to do the Northian, well, it depends how much money in it, depends how hard it is to turn it back. That's a good place to predict as a total stranger, but when you ask me what the right thing to do is, it's return the wallet. And I'd like to become that person. Are you saying I only have that urge in me? That's similar to my hunger urge, that's a hardwired thing? Because I don't know if that is that true. I mean, basically you're telling me that all my self-righteous goodness, I have to throw it out. I shouldn't feel self-righteous about it. It's no different than my hunger?
No, I'm not saying that. Now, remember, the hunger analogy is Adam Smith's. Oh. Adam Smith said we have a desire to be liked and admired, much like we get true. Hungry.
And he that says it's hardwired. Just, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. So, but the
No, that's a quote. Time out. That's to be liked. That's when people know that I've returned the wallet. I can say, I can post an Instagram of me returning the wallet or talk about it on Econ Talk like I did about visiting the hospital, and that ruins the whole thing in a way because it takes something that was noble and godly and turned into something tawdry and self-interested, right?
I hear you. And that was what McCulloch showed. Most people will keep the wallet if it's really true that you're not going to be caught.
But that's not what's interesting. What's interesting is that most people, there are some people who won't.
Yes. And I'm going to try to explain that.
Go ahead.
And here's the thing. Remember, I made a claim there were two things going on. One is an underlying genetic, evolutionarily selected capacity to care about morality. That's something that we connect with. But then there's also the individual project of construction of a character where I have a certain set of habits. I am the sort of person who does this.
Yes.
That is a mythology unless I, in fact, when presented with that setting, act in that way. And I know that all of my carefully cultivated story to myself, that I am the sort of person who returns wallets. If I don't return a wallet once, I can tell a story why that's true, but I know it's not true. I'm my own worst critic there. So this is, I want to argue, and I think the philosophers that are listening at this point, if they're still listening, they're probably not. But if they are, their heads are going to explode.
No one's listening. Go ahead. You and I are talking. Enjoy it.
We're just doing this. This is an example of rule utilitarianism. Rule utilitarianism would say that most of the time we're in a society, we don't have a chance to sit down and negotiate or what are we going to do here? What we have is a set of rules and habits. So if we're in a big city, it could be true that I really need to get somewhere. And if I could tell people, they would all let me go. But instead, we have stoplights. And stoplights are better than all of us negotiating at every intersection who should have priority.
Yep.
So rural utilitarianism says there's actually just a few little sets of rules that we can choose among. If you choose the one that's the best on average, sure, sometimes you end up paying costs. But you actually become invested in the rule that you've selected. And so I'm the sort of person who returns wallets. And I have cultivated that over time to the point where not only do I believe it, it's actually true. And then I have this chance to return a wallet, and I do it because I know that I am the sort of person who returns wallets. Now, you might be able to create a set of conditions where I would break that habit. But for some people, that it's hard won. That the fact that I'm the sort of person who does that, that's a hard won thing to be able to do. And that's what that's actually what Aristotle meant by character, was a kind of rule utilitarianism where you're choosing habits that if you were always to do this thing, you would be a better person and you'd be happier. Now, that might mean that sometimes you end up, in effect, sitting at a stoplight when it's red and there's no traffic coming the other way. It would be better in that instance to break it, but you're not going to do it because this is a habit that I've cultivated.
So it's so deep. And, of course, we talked about this in the Dan Klein episode about honest income, that this idea that you want to create, you want to habituate yourself to certain kinds of behavior. What's fascinating to me, and I had really never thought about this, is the parallel between this in individual choice and the parallel in public policy that sometimes gets summarized as rules versus discretion.
Right. Absolutely.
And there's so let me just lay that out quickly. The idea that, I mean, you don't want to rule, because sometimes rules
are terrible idea.
Rules are made to be broken. We can do better almost every time. And yet, once you open the Pandora's box of discretion, you find yourself erring, making mistakes, doing what's self-interested, harming your reputation, doing things you're ashamed of. So you have a rule. I don't eat the first potato chip. I don't have any drink. I don't just drink in moderation. I don't drink,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. And I always return wallets, even when they have $10 million in them and the owner is really far away. And he's a bad person, by the way, on top of it.
Yeah.
So that that idea of self-constraint, of tying yourself to the mast in an Odysseus-like method of giving up freedom, of giving up the discretion in this any one case – I have a feeling Buchanan would really like this. I mean, the whole idea there is this magnificent idea that you recognize your humanity. You recognize the imperfection of reason. And you understand that if you go to an all-discretion rule, bad choice of words, a world of all discretion, you open up the opportunity for you to be wicked. And so you sacrifice some well-being on average, because you know that the alternative is actually much worse, even though
it looks
like on paper that you could do a superior job by picking and choosing.
May I read an example? This comes from David Schmitz's wonderful book, 2006. David Schmitz, a philosopher at University of Arizona.
Past Econ Talk guest.
And the book is The Elements of Justice. And it's long, but I'll go over it quickly. So you come into a new town. And you're on the main street and you notice the cars are stopped on the side roads and you just keep going, but there's no stoplights or stop signs, but you're on the main road. You keep going. A cop comes up behind you and pulls you over. Do you know what you did wrong? Look, I'm sorry. There was no stop sign or stoplight. The cars on the cross street were stopped, so I kept going. The cop shook his head. In this town, sir, we distribute according to desert. That is, who deserves it. When motorists meet at an intersection, they stop to compare destinations and to ascertain which of them is more worthy of having the right of way. If you attend our high school track meet tomorrow night, you'll see it's the same thing. Instead of awarding gold medals for running fast, we award them for having the greatest effort. Anyway, that's why the other cars honk, because you didn't stop to compare destinations. The cop stared at me angrily. After a pause, I'm sorry, officer, I said at last. I know you have to be joking, but I'm afraid I don't get it. And the officer says, justice isn't a joke, sir. I was going to let you off with a warning until you said that. Well, there's no towns like that. But the point is that even if your concern is to maximize justice, you would have stoplights and stop signs. because stopping to argue about it, even if you eventually came to the right conclusion, would take up so much time that it would mean that the society would not be able to function very well. So there's really two considerations. One, I think, is your very apt distinction between rules and discretion. Having discretion means that you're going to get a bunch of rent-seeking contests where people know that the better argument they come up with, they're going to be able to win, when it's unlikely that the weak are going to win those contests. It's going to be unjust anyway. And the second is that it's just a giant waste of time. You're actually better on average doing the thing that seems not as good. So when you put those things together, it's all in Aristotle. Aristotle talks about cultivating a character in exactly those terms. He actually understood it in a way that I think is eerie. But I didn't realize that until I had thought enough about this to be able to read Aristotle. So I wonder if we shouldn't teach Aristotle to people when they're 50, not 15.
Yeah, well, we don't teach it much when they're 15 anymore. But so I'm still confused about my fundamental question.
And you didn't tell us your embarrassing example either.
Yeah, I'll get to that in a second. And then I have a final thing I want to talk about that's really maybe it'll be a good illustration of all this. But wouldn't it be better just to let the good times roll? Le bon temps rouler. Don't I want to just party and have a good time? What's this virtue, ethics, character nonsense? All that, those are all just additional constraints. How would you convince me? I'm my younger me, okay? Or your younger you. Why don't you make it personal for yourself since it's awkward lecturing me? Now, not that you're not experienced and good at it, but take your younger you. I'll take my younger me, and I'll say to myself, you know, you've acquired some, you're going to acquire. If you're not careful, I'm talking to my younger me. If you're not careful, you're going to acquire some guilt and shame and constraints on your behavior. It's going to really handicap you from having a good time. And my older me would say, actually, I kind of like the older me. And we come back to the vampire problem of L.A. Yeah, Paul.
Absolutely.
You know, when I'm younger, what looks like fun is not the same as when I'm older and I've given up some of it in return for something else. It comes back. We also have an invoked Agnes Callard, who talks about aspiration, which is similar to what we've been talking about today.
Absolutely, yes.
What I want to become, who do I see, what kind of person do I want to be? So I could say to my 18-year-old self, I wouldn't. This is the puzzle of life. Hey, don't be a sucker. Don't be like me, acquiring all these restraints, marriage, becoming religious in my case. Just talk about the moral sanctions you put on yourself. You'd be a lot happier. You could just be free to act and do what feels good. What do you say to that, Mr. Aristotle? How would you convince that 18-year-old? Why should the 18-year-old embark on that project of becoming the man that you think he ought to become?
Because right now, the 18-year-old can do things that are really fun. They are actually pretty darn fun. They feel good. I can eat and drink things that are bad for me, but boy, do they ever taste good. So I've had this argument a little bit, and mostly tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, with my good friend Jeffrey Brennan, who lives in Australia, a famous enophile. He has thousands of
people
bottles.
Like somebody who likes wine.
No, somebody not just likes, who really understands wine at a fundamental level.
But feel.
And so in Australia, they also sell wine in something they call a goon box, which I think is pretty self-explanatory. It is a box of really cheap wine. And
it's
I honestly suspect. I cannot. It's a fair-sized box. I cannot tell the difference between a goon box wine and one of Jeffrey's really lovely wines. And my question to Jeffrey is, why in the world would I cultivate a taste to make it so I have to spend $50 to get a level of enjoyment I get now from a $12 goon box? And by the way, a $12 goon box is three bottles. So we're really talking about $4. Now, I don't really believe that. And in fact, I can tell the difference. The other wine is better. Working on cultivating a preference and understanding, whether it be in a relationship or about something you're consuming, I think people just have to learn through experience is more satisfying, because just doing the same thing that feels good over and over again, I suppose you can become a connoisseur of those things and become really good at them, but it isn't the same as cultivating a deep understanding. And I don't know how you explain that except to model it ourselves. And so the difficulty that I think it happened that the house that I was raised in, my father didn't graduate from high school. He was deeply unhappy. He was frankly an abusive drunk. And I never got the feeling that his life was good. That was not really modeled to me. Now, I have since discovered that there really is something to cultivating. And my dad, I don't mean to blame my dad. He was living the best life he knew how to live.
He had some challenges, I'm sure.
But if your parents or if older people you admire and know model that, and again, this is a character question. It's really important that, because you can't tell young people, you'll be happier if you do it this way. But you can show them, look, I'm doing it this way. It seems to be some extra work, but it's really cool to be me. And if you can grow up and achieve this sort of level of understanding of yourself, you'll be happy at a level that now you cannot understand. I don't know how we communicate that, but that's what we have to do.
So I'm trying to do that in my book that I'm working on with respect to marriage. Marriage is, you know, I call it the any one day problem. Any one day you might wish you weren't married. Any one day you might wish you didn't have those rules that you've adopted. I want to be the kind of person who... And it's not just the tawdry part of it, but just even just day to day, it's sometimes marriage is not easy. Living with another person is challenging, but it's glorious. And, you know, conveying what's glorious about it does not come easily to the, I think, to words. So I've come to think about it. The kind of thing you're talking about is, to pick a really inappropriate example, it's like single malt, smoky single malt scotch. So my brother, who's a fine person, when I offer him a single malt scotch, a smoky one like Lagavulin or Lafroig, he does not like it. Of course, I didn't like it the first time either. And when I tell him—
You had to cultivate it.
It's an acquired taste. And that phrase, you know, I heard that phrase as a child to refer to things like anchovies and it turns out single malt scotch. But it's actually quite a deep summary of what we've been talking about. It says— There are certain tastes you might want to acquire, not just about scotch, but about how you behave and what you do. And I'm going to use, I hope I get to use this in the book, but you know, if you're the first time you drink Lafroig, it's people say it's like licking an ashtray. That sounds horrible. but Lafroig had a contest to describe what it's like to drink Lafroig, and the winner was, it's like kissing a mermaid who just ate barbecue. And that is one of the most divine descriptions of a physical pleasure that I can think of. It's just perfect. That person deserves more than a prize. They deserve honor and glory. But I'm going to close with this embarrassing personal story. Add whatever you want to my Lafroix thing in a minute. But this is a little bit risky, but we do this all the time, like you and me, because we're friends and this is off the beaten track of what we're talking about in a way, but it's not at all. So I'm reading Persuasion, which is a website, not the Jane Austen novel. And there's a column that Kat Rosenfield writes. And this is from October 25th, 2020. And the second question she was asked was, that she answers, is the following. Should I contest my friend's stupid ideas or just shut up? And that question, I have cultivated a habit that I used to think was a good habit of challenging my friend's stupid ideas. I mean, I'm an educator. So when people say something stupid, I explain to them why they're wrong. It's deeply ingrained in me, and I've always thought, I've never thought about it. It's actually this genetic desire for justice, perhaps, or some other cultural thing I've got of justice that, well, in some sense, something's wrong. And by the way, it's stupid. I don't mean just things like thinking that Marseille is the capital of France. I mean, thinking like the minimum wage is a good idea. I mean, that's the kind of thing I want to fight at a dinner party. And I've talked about it in the program many times. There's a number of dinner parties I've been at where I said something that wasn't taken well. I didn't mean it badly. I meant to just educate and correct. And you know, my wife doesn't think it's the best habit, so I've worked to quell it. over time, and I've gotten better at it. I get thrown out of fewer dinner parties, or I'm forced to leave embarrassedly, or more accurately, I don't feel as much shame when I do leave, but because I've created a scene, not because I disagreed, but I did it in a way that was not nice. But she makes this great point. She says, well, your friend didn't ask you to be corrected. And I have found this to be, I haven't really fully absorbed it yet, but it's a way of flipping the dinner party dilemma on its head. It's like, instead of saying, well, that's obviously wrong, I must speak up here, it's my moral duty, because they're obviously wrong, and they want to be corrected.
They should want to be corrected. They may not know it, but they're the sort of person that would be embarrassed to say something wrong. And so I'm doing them a favor.
Exactly. And now it's like, why is it almost my whole life I've thought I have a moral imperative to explain something to someone? So this is this column, and you can read 50 things like this sometimes in your life, and they don't go in. Probably not the first thing I've ever read about whether you should disagree with a stranger at a dinner party. But this kind of made me think a little bit. Like, maybe that I'm the kind of person who ought to be a different kind of person. I'm the kind of person who, when one person at one dinner party says something that I think is, say, economics 000 instead of 101, maybe I should just suck it up and be quiet and say, they're probably happy believing that. And for them to be told an alternative, may not even accept it. And even if they do, is the world really a better place for that? I mean, that's kind of stupid. So I've had kind of an earth shaking. I haven't fully absorbed it yet, but I just wanted to share that because it's not unlike your line experience. It's like what I would call, moral smugness, moral self-righteousness I know what's right. I have an obligation to share what's right. Now, of course, here I am, the host of a program that a lot of people are listening to. I think, some of you are listening maybe because you want to learn something. And so I do have this urge to educate and to teach. But maybe it's not maybe the same appropriate urge in all settings, hypothetically.
Well, I hate to be fair to you, but I feel like I have to be fair to you. I have listened to every one of the podcasts, not just the 37 in the past that I was on, but to all of the Econ Talk podcasts.
All 770 episodes?
I have, and some of them I've listened to 3 or 4 times. You do not take the same approach now that you did in 2006 to confronting error.
It's true.
And in fact, there are a number of occasions, and one of the ones that really sticks out in my mind is you have cultivated a habit of getting better at this. One that sticks out in my mind is the one with Peter Singer. Mm-hmm. You did not respond to Peter Singer saying, that's the dumbest damn thing I've ever heard. What you said was, well, now, how did you come to that conclusion? What's the basis for the reasoning? And when he explained it, it was, that's actually pretty interesting. He probably has a point. So in particular, I think it may have made a difference for you. It's made a difference for me. His view is sort of nuanced view of vegetarianism and the fact that there are many things that we could do to make industrial farming of animals less horrific for the animals. That may be something that, in fact, we have an obligation to do. Peter Singer has a point. So if your reaction to error is to ask questions, which is what you do now, you clearly have cultivated a habit of doing that, to find out what is the basis of that person's belief, rather than just thinking what they really wanted, what they really wanted was a 5-minute disquisition from me saying, well, here's what proper people think, and you're improper, you should be embarrassed. So a response, and one can cultivate this. And I have to admit, the reason I have this reaction is I'm a libertarian at Duke University. Yeah. And so many of my colleagues on the left take exactly this view. Their response is, now, can you tell us why you think that? And a lot of time they'll say, well, that's actually interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I'm not sure I agree, but I've actually learned something. So thanks. So I'm the person who was sitting beside you at the dinner party if you had been a very strong leftist. And my colleagues have not said, well, that's just wrong and here's why. They said, well, why do you think that? So being able to cultivate that, having a dinner party is a place where you have liberty. And the liberty to do what you ought to will is to ask questions that advance the conversation, not end the conversation with people looking at their watches timing you, saying, here he goes again, 17 minutes. If you see people surreptitiously timing your speeches at a dinner party, that's a bad sign.
I'm worried that your dog thinks that you're listening to an Econ Talk episode. You're about to start yelling. But I really appreciate that. Seriously, every bit of it, what you just said. But I have to say something honest in response to it. And we'll play it as a game for our guests. And then we'll take this conversation home with there's going to be a visual treat for viewers. Listeners will only hear a description of it. But don't worry, Mike's going to keep his shirt on, I hope. But
you said treat, so.
Yeah, exactly. in the Peter Singer episode, when you said, that's interesting, and you thought maybe I'd learn something, I was thinking of a different part of the episode when I said that, and that isn't what I was actually thinking. I was actually trying to be polite. There may have been a moment in the vegetarian part where I was actually being conceding that there was an interesting point there. That episode was very hard for me.
I know.
Perhaps you and I will. I've been thinking a lot about the drowning child in the pond example that he uses, and why I find it so troubling. So I hope he will either revisit that with me, or you and I will talk about it, because it's an area I'm sure you're interested in. But let's close with the visual thing. Mike's going to pause here for a second. He's going to just turn his camera a little bit. Right now, you don't have to get up. Just tilt your, or did you move it too far? There it is. Oh, you can kind of see it. I'm getting the tail end there. He's going to move. For those of you following on audio only, Mike has the head of a unicorn in his office. It's a beautiful office with a lot of books scattered about, and books that he's been abusing, obviously. They look like they've had a long day at the office.
And a number of ties, but there's my unicorn.
Yeah. Why do you have a unicorn head on a tripod as opposed to, say, a pike, right? In the old days, they would put the bad people's heads on pikes. This is a unicorn's head on a tripod.
Usually I have a sweatshirt over the tripod so that it looks like the unicorn is a sort of unicornish scarecrow. The unicorn is my spirit animal, as many of my readers and watchers of the video would know. And I will send to Russ the link for the unicorn video. It involves strawberries. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, you know, it's colorful. But Mike has talked about this before on the program for those longtime Munger fans, the idea of certain political solutions being more fantasy than reality, I think, will be the hint that captures that. Is anything you want to say in closing about anything we've talked about today, Mike?
No, I think that since I did the second interview with you on Econ Talk in 2006, the direction that you have taken have reflected some. Maybe it's personal growth. Maybe it's some directions that a lot of people have dissatisfaction with the discipline of economics. I think a lot of people are sort of moving in this direction. So I want to encourage people to continue to think about this problem of cultivating what sort of person I should be and what sort of person one should be. That sort of project, in addition to getting in better shape, becoming better looking, can result in a sort of a knowledge of yourself that makes you not just happier, but a much more fun person to be around. So it also can be a lot more self-interested. Not that I think for a moment that Russ ever really acted badly at a dinner party.
My guest today has been Mike Munger. Mike, as always, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
It was a pleasure.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.